Hey folks, this is Craig. We finally made it to our episode on Mark Fisher and post-capitalist desire. Given the topic, we will be talking about the suicide of Mark Fisher somewhat, so consider this a content warning. Also, the full version of this episode is available to Patreon subscribers. Go ahead and subscribe there to grab it. However, if you're a little bit strapped for cash right now, just hit me up on Twitter and we'll work something out. Okay, let's get to the episode. This is Acid Horizon, a theory podcast which confronts global crisis and the specter of a world that could be free. This is episode 15, Post-Capitalist Desire, The Final Lectures, a reading of Mark Fisher's final lectures with author Matt Colquhoun. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to Acid Horizon, the theory podcast. Today we have Matt Colquhoun on the show. He is our first repeat guest, achievement unlocked. And he is here to talk about his writing and involvement with curating the final lectures of Mark Fisher in conjunction with Repeater Books, the book out now on ebook and very soon in a limited tangible release is Post-Capitalist Desire, the Final Lectures. Matt, how have you been?
All right, thanks. It's very nice to be back with you guys chatting about things for another strange book about politics that's come out in the weird lockdown. So probably very much the same as we were last time we were talking. Very little change in the world.
Well, yeah, maybe just as an icebreaker. I know you moved and everything. I mean, are you settled in now or what?
I'm moving this week. Actually, I'm not quite made the move yet. I'm surrounded by boxes at home.
And interestingly, people may not know this. I'm sure it's coincidence entirely, Matt, but the place you're moving to, Huddersfield, is where we met when we were both presenting papers on the 20th anniversary of capitalist realism at the University of Huddersfield. So I'm sure it's complete coincidence that you've moved there after that.
It is really weird because I'm from, Huddersfield's in West Yorkshire. I'm from East Yorkshire originally. And when we met in January this year, that was the first time I'd ever been to Huddersfield. And now suddenly looking to move there. I'm not really sure why, but I'm very looking forward to it. But it's
a nice place.
Yeah, it is nice. It's going to be nice to be back in that part of the world, for sure.
Yeah. Everybody's moving. Will's moving. I'm moving. Yeah. I think Adam's the only stable person on this podcast.
No, I am moving, but to a slightly different part of London that's racist and alcoholic and entirely new and original way.
Yeah, so you'll be there and, I'll be wherever the hell I end up.
Well, let's kick off this discussion about the book, shall we? So we're talking about Post-Capitalist Desire. So maybe, Matt, you can just tell us how, and I think maybe we talked about this in the previous episode, but it's worth mentioning again. How did this project come about? And what will readers get from this entry into the Mark Fisher oeuvre that they may not find in other publications of his?
This was, I guess, it's quite strange that this project has kind of come to fruition in a lot of ways because these lectures that Mark gave in the last few months of 2016, between, I think, October and December, the recordings for these lectures have been floating around the internet for quite a while. We had them at Goldsmiths, almost just very soon after Mark died. I think people were, there was this general effort to gather together a lot of what Mark had done just for the sake of, I think, I'm not really sure why actually. It's kind of there was this strange, I think it was part of the whole housekeeping of grief in a weird way. We kind of went through everything that was in Mark's office and everything that he'd written about online that wasn't very well known about. And these lectures just kind of hung around as this, quite amazing document of what he was doing in the last sort of few months and everything he'd been working on, I guess, for a few years. I made the decision to try and transcribe them back in 2017. I just transcribed the first lecture and shared it about a bit online. And then it was doing that led to my book Egress, in a way. That's kind of the was the catalyst for really looking at Mark's work properly and seeing what he was doing. And in a way, it's kind of happened backwards, that my book Egress came out in March and then lockdown happened, and it sort of felt like, well, here's a good opportunity, a good piece of time to actually deal with this stuff that's been lingering around for so long and get out in the world. And I'm really happy that it's kind of come out in a way, because I think the initial response of the people have had to what I think a lot of us were quite nervous about being, I guess there's a certain fetishization that comes out of transcriptions of lectures by certain well-known public figures. And I mean, I've spent a lot of my own time reading transcriptions of lectures by Badiou and people like Lacan. And there's this weirdness to that kind of project that's, can be quite insightful, but jarring. And, especially Lacan's ones, they're not exactly, any more passable for being in a kind of more informal setting. But I think that with these lectures of Marx, I think managed to do something a bit different, where I think it feels both like a capstone to this life of thought and also like quite an interesting introduction maybe to people that aren't that familiar with what he was doing, sort of beyond the maybe what he's known for.
Yeah, I mentioned to you shortly after receiving and reading a fair portion of the book that it was great because the material was very visceral and it kind of puts you in the lecture space. And for me, this happened in a way that seemed even more intimate than, for example, watching one of Mark's lectures on YouTube or maybe just listening to it. So as somebody who's taken class with Mark, what do you think are the beautiful things that have been recovered in your transcription, or what do you think might be lost?
Yeah, that's what's been so weird about the initial reception being quite so. Everyone said the same thing, that you feel like you're in the room, which people sort of say with a certain amount of surprise, given the fact you're just reading the thing. That's the intention on my part as the transcriber, to try and make the kind of decisions that maybe give this this strange thing that you're reading some sort of tangibility. But I didn't think that it would be anything that anyone would actually think about. I kind of just thought, what's the best way to put this into words? I mean, it is just essentially, yeah, it's very, I don't know. It's kind of quite amazing that people feel that way. And I think that it's just, if anything, I think it's a testament to Mark, really, how he just really jumps off the page in much the same way he sort of would jump around a room. I think even in some of the lectures that people see, I think Mark has this really enviable ability to just be able to talk. You'll rarely see a lecture that he gives where he's reading from some sort of written essay or anything like that. He will just start and then someone will say stop. And what he manages to just get out in that kind of approach is pretty astounding. And I think that maybe what comes across is that in these lectures, and it might even be something that's more apparent in the recordings themselves, but Mark's kind of, he's battling, I think, in these lectures to, he's not being listened to uncritically, which I think is interesting. And there's a lot of times where his students will challenge what he's saying, not take anything as a given, question where he's coming from, what his own choices. But the way that he manages to kind of deal with that in a way, to actually not just defend himself, but kind of actually, he's both lecturer and kind of like advocate for this other world. But you're sort of reading him convince people in real time that another world is possible.
Reading these lecture series has actually sort of retroactively sort of tied together something that I sort of was always struggling to sort of comprehend and sort of being around sort of the legacy of Fisher, because the sort of space he's making in these lecture halls is so mutually constructive. It's almost like a demonstration of the sort of his own sort of type of consciousness raising. And it, for me, it kind of felt like the sort of space that I'd never quite understood when I was interacting with legacy beforehand, especially when it rounded off two events for me reading this. The first one was the second, I think, Mark Titcher Memorial Lecture I was at when Jody Dean spoke.
Yes, yeah.
And the second one was reading Egress, which was, the sense of community there is something that I always sort of intimated, but I could never quite get. And it was sort of a process of me retroactively sort of understanding the sort of space, the creative space, the very open space, and the very comradely space, is in the very Jody Dean sense of it, that Mark was trying to make at this time. And sort of when I originally went to the first lecture, I was mainly, I was coming from this, you know, from knowing the Mark Fisher of capitalist realism and the sort of more, slightly more negative essays and the Vampire Castle stuff. And then hearing this sort of very comradely talk, albeit interrupted by it, let's be honest, an incredibly hostile and uncooperative audience, really sort of really flew over my head until I got to these lectures and sort of understood the sort of community that he was trying to build, sort of the Fisher function that he was playing. So that was a really like personally good part of the experience of reading like these transcriptions for me.
Yeah, as I read the lectures, I couldn't help but notice Mark's just wonderful pedagogical style. He just seems so upfront and engaging on the page even. And I was curious, do you and the others who were around him see that as an important part of his legacy in terms of them becoming academics? Or is there any way that it has impacted your approach to your academic work, your para-academic work, or your writing?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't kind of thought about that before. I think a lot of people that... I mean, I guess that's the thing to emphasize about Goldspitz and the lectures that Mark gave. In this context, from the courses that we're reading here, it's very much it's a postgraduate course. He's teaching on a master's degree. And those students were kind of, I think that was what was so strange for a lot of us that were in that postgraduate year when Mark died, is that there was, you know, he was sort of a fleeting figure almost. At best, you'd known him for a year before if you'd been doing the course part-time. Otherwise, you were like me and you'd kind of known him for just a couple of months before he passed away. But I think what a lot of the impetus, especially the activity that's described in Egress, came out of the relationships that Mark had with his undergraduate students. And a lot of my closest friends who still spend a lot of time with here in London were undergraduate students when I was a postgrad. And it's their sense of attachment to his work that I think is most profound and most sort of palpable. And it's not, you know, they're not academics still. You know, most of them have either graduated, maybe they started in 2017, so they've either just graduated now or maybe they graduated at that time. Everyone that sort of grew up around that, maybe there's like a 6-year period there of like 3 years before, 3 years after, where, you know, everyone that was embedded in that moment, still all pretty young people in their mid-20s. So I don't think anyone's carving out careers to be academics just yet, but most of them are artists. I guess that's the point to make for Goldsmiths especially, is that Mark's teaching on an undergraduate level, even in the postgraduate, to be fair. He's not in a room with theorists alone. He's in a room with, I think that's something else that comes across in the lecture in the way. I remember there's one exchange with one student who's talking about universal basic income. And she's sort of saying, you know, I'm a designer. And how would this kind of post-capitalist world change what I do and why I do it? And that's kind of, I think, it says a lot about the environment that Mark was working in. And maybe that's something that could have even been emphasized in hindsight more. But Mark had very eclectic classrooms. The impact, I guess, of people that I knew that are sort of there in and around the background of Egress and whatever else, and in very much in this lecture series, all the students have been anonymized, but many of the people that are talking in that lecture are friends. And it's very, everyone's sort of gone in and explored it in very different ways. I've got two friends who just had their own sort of like a radio residency out of Newcastle here in the UK, who had this discussion. They have a podcast called Incursions. You can probably find it on SoundCloud. And they had this conversation a couple of weeks ago where they talked to my very close friend, Natasha Eves, who has organized a bunch of K-pop-related activities with me around here in South London. Dan Taylor, who was another student of Mark's, actually way back in the day. Dan wrote Island Story. I think it's called Island Story for Repeater Books. Just finished another book about Spinoza that's coming out on Edinburgh University Press. And then there's a few other people. And Dan's interesting because he was a student of Mark's when Mark was teaching at the Further Education College that he used to teach at. So Dan was this sort of... he's one of the generation that capitalist realism was written directly for. And there's this sense in this, I've been thinking about a lot this past week, because there's this, Natasha's talking about what we did in 2017. Dan's talking about his own sense of community and relationship to Marx's work. And they're exactly the same. There's this same sense of talking about community, friendship, things that, yeah, in a way, maybe this kind of consciousness raising vibe that maybe sounds a bit twee in the wrong context, as if to say, I mean, because they're quite hollow words. And I think Mark even addresses a couple of those things. I think he addresses the word community, which I used a lot in my book, but he talks about it as sort of being a kind of a very promiscuous word. You can refer to a community of people, or you can refer to like a business community or the international community. It's a word that's kind of entangled up with too many different meanings to really mean anything.
It's one of the things that I miss most about being in school, right? Yeah, and this is one of the reasons I created the podcast, is to get some semblance of that back into my life.
Yeah, well, I think that's it. It's like, it's that atmosphere. It's like doing this sort of thing that I think Mark spawned so many different kinds of podcasts. I think that says a lot. That's doing this kind of conversation right here is I think says so much about the sort of diffusing influence over those years. Because it's this kind of project that seems to like really resonate with people as a way to actually, you know, yeah, deal with these ideas by actually dealing with them.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add there, just as a sort of anecdote, that so my dad is, I guess he's somewhat conservative, but probably more on the liberal end of that, put it that way. But he's been teaching for about 40, 45 years now, I think. And the other day I read him a few paragraphs from Capitalist Realism. It was a bit which spoke to the experience of students and teachers. It's that bit where we talk about the student who has his headphones on, and Mark comes over and says, you know, could you please take him off? And he says, well, I'm not listening to anything, you know, it's on mute, right? And I read in both few paragraphs about it, and the role of teacher, where, you know, they're simultaneously meant to sort of entertain the students but also discipline them and so on. And it was interesting to me that so much of what he wrote there even appealed to my dad, you know, who would always have a instinctive kind of distrust of, you know, this sort of French theory stuff with their wishy-washy language or whatever, you know. It says something to what Mark was able to do with his pedagogy, that his writing could even speak to someone like, you know, like my dad, actually.
I think accessibility is like essential to Fisher's function, because in so many different ways, you know, part of what the sort of Anglo world often has brought to philosophy can be sort of boiled down to extraordinarily analytical interpretations of French text, to the point where they almost mean nothing. I know we had Andrew Culp on to discuss the way in which Foucault functions in philosophical discourse. What I like about Fisher's lectures here, and we've touched on it, and I think it was a really smart decision on your part and on whatever repeater expected from this, was to maintain sort of the interruptions and sort of sometimes the confused nature of the questions, the simple nature of the questions sometimes, because like this is the way in which one should attend a class, right? These are the sorts of questions that one needs to be able to ask. And the ease and grace with which Mark Fisher answers fundamental questions about Marcuse, Deleuze, Lukács, I actually find these lectures to be super, super important to me, just at the level of like pedagogically understanding all of this. So I think too, like that's something that shines through in this book, because in some ways I never really got to sort of see the way in which Mark Fisher operates as a teacher, because those experiences are fundamental to specifically to capitalist realism, but also ghosts of my life. So I think that's one thing that I found particularly interesting. How did you feel working in these sorts of interruption? How did you maintain a sort of flow in these lectures to sort of make a cohesive mass out of these interactions?
there was a lot of things that initially, I think, I'm surprised I didn't completely lose my mind in doing this, to be fair, because I think it was about 10 hours worth of recordings and I listened to them over and over again.
Oh, wow.
There's multiple passes to try and like transcribe this stuff. I mean, that's why it was great to do it in lockdown, because it wasn't like I had anything else to do. But I think it's that, I distinctly remember now, like in hindsight, that with each pass, it was sort of like things that you just otherwise leave out felt really important to like situating. I guess that's it, is that Marx, it's demonstrating how Marx thought was situated in his like actual environment. But the main example that I remember was that it didn't end up putting it in until maybe the last pass, where at the very start of the first lecture, Mark's trying to introduce things by playing these clips off YouTube, and he can't get the sound to work. And he's kind of narrating this fact that it's like, well, because he sort of makes the realization in real time, where he's showing this the Apple Super Bowl 1984 commercial, where he's sort of talking about it as like, here's Apple introducing itself into this world of like home computing, by sort of showing how it's going to be sexy and new and colorful against this kind of dreary gray world that is IBM.
Yeah, and I think too, like there's this moment where it all sort of culminates into this like literally like beautiful inability to get a projector working properly.
Right, well, exactly.
Yeah, so and I thought like, that's essential.
Yeah. Well, that's it. It's like it's the sort of thing that hearing, putting in sort of, I guess it's trying to focus so much on the clarity of Marx's argument. It was initially, it's the sort of fact when he mumbles about a projector not working, it's the sort of thing that you think, well, maybe that's just doesn't need to be here. But the more and more I listen to it, it's like the more important that kind of thing felt. I guess the other side of it is that there's a lot of times where students come in late. And maybe there'd be this, I don't even know how well this comes across, but it sticks with me a lot in from listening to it and typing it up, where students come in late, and rather than Mark sort of being frustrated at being interrupted or maybe slightly miffed about someone walking into his lecture late, he's like, sorry, you know, the room's not very hard to find. He kind of gives this sort of diffuse background about how strange it is to operate in the university as an institution.
Like the moment with the late student, you know, he goes on to show sort of the physical barrier that the structure has, right? Because it was, the room is hard to find. Oh, and it's simply not big enough.
Yeah. And I mean, it's true. I mean, the Goldsmiths is a kind of a strange place, and, it's quite an old building. But it has been sort of refurbished over the years. And a lot of these little places, like, a lot of these classrooms are, just everything about it. It's probably a common experience, I imagine, to anyone that's sort of been to university, where the way that these rooms are numbered over this, you know, there's hundreds of rooms in this building, and the way that they are, they're not numbered in any way that makes sense. So, but just that as that kind of like this kind of nested understanding of how his own work comes to life, not just talking about the fact that like navigating our lives through capitalism is complicated, and it's like, yeah, no shit, like it's it's almost at the level of we live in a society sort of thing, right? It's like it's a truism that almost loses all sense of meaning, and it's like Mark has this amazing ability to like,
yeah, and two, that's like part of his whole position with capitalist realism is often sort of the reflexive impotence, right, of the refrain that, oh, we live in a society. This is merely, you know, the processes that we go through. You can't simply undo it. You can't simply move beyond it. Like, these are the cycles that we have. This is the monotony that we subject ourselves to. And, oh, we'll just simply find joy in like buying Dolce & Gabbana, or like really enjoying that one Xbox game or whatever it be, your family and stuff. So I think that's also just essential to the way that his work operates. And I think it's unique in the way that it goes about trying to find a new way to raise consciousness.
I guess it's part of it. It comes down to, I guess just on the point of, I guess almost what makes me want to talk about in you saying that is, I guess it's this question of desire that runs through the whole thing. And I think that's related to that in a way that you can, maybe what's so nice about these lectures from this, even just as a listener, like, and a reader myself, in enjoying like reading this stuff that he's saying, is that you, I guess you can sense this desire to be there. and to be there for his students. And in a way, that's kind of like this unspoken foundation that allows that builds up the rest of these pretty complex and sometimes theoretically intense arguments that he's building up to and trying to discuss.
And he's very generous in his responses to students. And I'll say, I got a sense from reading the lectures that among the questions students ask, there were no duds. Everybody in that room was brilliant. I mean, there's times where you could tell the students maybe didn't have a full grasp on the concept or the material, but he would never condescend to them. He would always take their questions.
Well, it's essential to ask those questions, right? Like, that's the mark of a good student, is one who is willing to ask the foundational questions. Because if you just masquerade, like, I know we've already talked so much on how to do grad school, but if you just masquerade as an intelligent person in class, even though, like, you didn't you struggled with the whatever section of capital you were assigned, so on, you will struggle. You have to have sort of the strength to ask those questions. And that's why I think that the interactions there are both really hard for someone like Matt to transcribe in that sense, like makes them really difficult, but makes those classrooms valuable.
I just want to say that when I was getting my MA, my phenomenology teacher just used to roll his eyes when people ask questions. And so
terrible. Absolute peak phenomenology professor.
Yeah, so there's the difference. Well, maybe we'll just get on to the next part here, because we read the lectures, and it's interesting because just like Power Rangers, we each like locked into a different lecture, and I think there's five of them, and there's five Power Rangers, right?
Really? Really, Craig?
I've been talking about Pokemon and Power Rangers in these recent episodes. I don't know.
Yikes.
It's a kind of hauntology. But anyway, Will, you had some interesting comments or questions about the Marcuse lecture.
I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how Marcuse sort of is front-loaded into Anti-Oedipus, where he takes sort of a really, really alternative reading of Eros and Civilization. And I mean, I guess not an alternative, but he really favors the one particular way in which Marcuse engages with Freud, which is at the level of Freud's more abstract understanding of unconscious and how it sort of abandoning this idea of a superego that we get out of sort of later understandings. And I was wondering if you could talk about the relationship between Marcuse and Fisher's reading of Anti-Oedipus, because it was one area in the lectures where like I struggled a little bit to make those explicit connections.
Yeah, damn, big question.
Yeah, I know.
Spot now.
Yeah, shit.
Maybe you should start by explaining the entirety of Eros and Civilization. That should be easy.
Well, that's kind of what I'm thinking. Let me see.
Do you know who Herbert Marcuse is? I'm just kidding.
Yeah, it's kind of this strange. There's this strange chronology or lack of in the lectures. I mean, Marx is at a few points, you know, there's not really any Deleuze or Guattari here in these lectures. And he kind of talks about them as this kind of this they're very notable in their absence, but they kind of are, you know, you could do this entire course just with their texts, I almost feel like is what he's trying to say. So it's like, it's better to leave them out and actually work around them. Because you know, in a modern university like Goldsmiths, they're pretty prevalent anyway. So, especially like an art institution, for better or for worse. But I think what Mark is, well, the question of how Deleuze and Guattari read Marcuse is something that I don't even know I'd be able to do any justice to. But I think what links them sort of implicitly for Mark is there's this focus that is sort of constant, I think, not just in this lecture series, but throughout all of Mark's work and the work of other people that were sort of around the initial like blogosphere and the CCIU and basically his whole entire career, where there's this tension at all times to bridge this understanding of political philosophy with aesthetics and culture. And I think that's partly why, so in this lecture where Marx's talking about Marcuse, he's sort of introducing him as this thinker. I think Eros and Civilization comes out in the 1950s at some point, and it's kind of, it presages the counterculture that was to come. And I think that what's most important, I mean, it's from Marcuse that this famous line now comes that I think is almost, it's almost like the sort of the end of the world is easy to imagine the end of capitalism. Sort of Marx's use of that phrase, despite it not being his coinage, is so associated with him. And I feel like had he lived, the next version of that would be the spectre of a world that could be free. That would become as much Mark Fisher's phrase as it would be Marcuse's. And it's from Eros and Civilization that Mark takes that that sentence, which I think is pretty present in the Acid Communism introduction that's been so popular since Mark's death. And I guess that what Marcuse does so brilliantly in Eros and Civilization is he does something very similar to what Deleuze and Guattari do, where he sort of takes Freud and considers maybe not just what the Freudian theories are articulating sort of in themselves, but kind of underneath the surface, like what is this kind of thinking saying about this moment in which Freud is writing? And I think that's kind of like what it's kind of that meta psychology stuff. Is that what I'm trying to think if that's what Freud calls it? The kind of psychoanalyzing of psychoanalysis. It's kind of the beginning of that moment that I think sort of not only becomes like a really valuable process within, I mean, all of post-Freudian psychoanalysis, but also just in sort of 21st century thought. Why do we think the things we do? Almost coming from Nietzsche to this genealogy of morals type thing. Marcuse and Deleuze and Guattari are kind of doing their own sort of versions of those things. Deleuze and Guattari quite explicitly with like something like the geology of morals. And I almost feel like in a way, Marx kind of trying to do something similar maybe. That these figures are so important because of the way that they maybe not only understand the material that they're working with, but kind of understand, they manage to sort of see it from outside itself and see the impact on this kind of thought on all of us, whether we're familiar with this stuff or not. I guess that's what's quite mind-blowing at times, where you can sort of talk about figures like Deleuze and Guattari and think, what's all this highfalutin niche philosophical, you know, wankery, but at the same time, like what they're talking about in this very specific way has such a profound relevance to just how everybody thinks in the present moment. And they do a lot of the work to uncover that stuff. So in the way, I don't even know this could possibly come close to answering your question. But I feel like if there's some sort of gesture or trajectory that
I think it's absolutely great. What's interesting is the point about genealogy is not even something that I even considered in relation between the two. Like I was just like, oh, okay. Like I guess it comes down to desire. No, but there's like methodological relationships between these two as well. And that's part of the reason why I find these lectures so fascinating. I know Craig has some questions about, because this is about the same spot in the text, so I want to try to keep it a little bit cohesive for listeners who are like trying to read this so that we're not like bouncing all over, you know, ruining parts of the things. We'll just move along with them. He has some questions about the limitations of standpoint when it comes to consciousness raising. So I'll just hand it over to Craig.
Oh, sure. Actually, this was going to be Adam's part, but maybe I'll set it up this way. Well, Will, you'll remember, and Adam was there too, we did the episode on Foucault and the feminist philosophy of disability. And rather than asserting a position, I'm actually curious to know whether or not, I'm curious to know how Mark rectified the tensions between the post-structuralists he's working with and this affinity, it seems, for Lukács and standpoint theory. Because, you know, as we touched on in that episode, there is kind of a friction between those two approaches to examining oppression, for example. And so I'm wondering if that ever became apparent to you in working with him.
I think maybe the question that's kind of maybe these two questions that are kind of similar, this one about Marcuse and Deleuze Guattari and then Marx and this, yeah, the standpoint stuff, whereas I guess that's this it's this strange double articulation that's always going on. Thinking in terms of, you reminded me when you were saying about genealogy, and I guess the most important thing to acknowledge for something like Anti-Oedipus is that it's a book that is kind of anti-genealogy in that sense. It's like, how do you understand, at the most basic level of talking about the family, in terms of the Oedipus complex, like how do you understand your very situatedness in this institution of the family? And yet also, you know, find a way out of its the pressure it puts on us, the kind of super egoic level. And I guess that maybe that's the same issue when it comes to with Mark and standpoint stuff. And I think the difficulty of almost, what I find strange about the whole standpoint lectures, and it all sounds very convenient. It sounds very easy to say. The way Mark puts it is it defines a standpoint. As a standpoint is like is a bit like a point of view, but it's sort of saying, but without the sort of relativism of postmodernism, as if to say that, you know, it's we all have our different points of view, but some points of view are better than others, like categorically, because you have, you know, if you're at the bottom of the ladder, you have a far better view of the top than someone looking down. Like, will have this. As if to look from the bottom up is far more, you see far more of the totality that way in which you are embedded than you do from, you know, being at the top and looking down on the serfs below you. And I guess that what part of the problem with postmodernism and a lot of what Mark's talking about in terms of how we're able to actually define ourselves in this moment of, I guess, identity politics and all the controversy around that kind of discourse, is that there's obviously this desire to really ground ourselves as individuals and as members of certain communities, but we're kind of stuck between both those perspectives. We're expected to see things from the top up, from the top down, and the bottom up.
Right, right. And I think too, though, that like, Fisher's not engaging in a sort of like what you see online of with like, you know, Marxist like Twitter posters or like Facebook screed posters about like identity politics, you know, because he does see sort of a clear intersection between, for one example that's prevalent in the book, patriarchy and capital. So he does make it clear that people can relate to it in different ways, but what to him, what's central is that they all have this sort of, there's this inhibitive relationship between capital, desire, and the subject. And that is, in a sense, sort of the stagnant role of capital over all bodies.
Yes.
And so I think in that sense, these lectures do a good job in pointing out that really, really specific way in which he goes about addressing these issues relating to standpoint.
Yeah, I don't think I could have put it better myself, really. I agree.
Yeah, I know. I think this comes back to desire, which means in a certain sense we have to bring up Marcuse. And I was talking to Matt earlier, and he mentioned that he had just like one thing that he wanted to bring up. I don't even remember what it is.
Yeah, so the title of the book is Post-Capitalist Desire, right? And I guess, so by way of asking the question, you know, what is post-capitalist desire? Like, what does it mean? What does it look like for Mark Fisher? I thought what I'd do is I'd sort of say a little bit about Marcuse, and we could see where there are similarities and where there are differences. So if we take it, you know, in a simplified version, of course, you know, from Eros and Civilization, that civilization and capitalism in particular represses a whole range of energies which it, you know, at some point in the past it may have needed to, but of course now no longer needs to, and it's been overridden by this performance principle instead, and that therefore we need to sort of push for the liberation of these desires. What you find in Marcuse's later works, and he returns to this in his preface, is sort of this notion that it's almost like the problem is exactly the opposite in some ways, for later Marcuse, in that it unleashes almost, you know, desire becomes this kind of Pandora's box which can't be put back within that box, right? And that's sort of maybe what you find in Deleuze and Guattari to an extent as well. So I guess I wanted to ask, in terms of what post-capitalist desire is, how do you think Mark related to the idea that capitalism on the one hand, you know, does it sort of repress or unleash desires, and what's sort of a path through that to a post-capitalist desire?
Come join us and subscribe on Patreon to listen to the rest of this episode. We're talking about Deleuze and Guattari, Lyotard, standpoint theory, and more. If you find you're a little bit strapped for cash right now, just come and find me on Twitter and I will give you the link for free. I just want you to be part of the discussion. Okay, we'll see you next time.